to Forge the Narrative.
Hey everybody, welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. We are about Lost Halls Podcast. This is episode 323. I'm joined tonight by Ricky Addington.
I'm awake.
And Adam Camilleri.
Hello, my babies. Hello, my honeys. Hello, my 40k gals.
What's going on? I got the smooth bathtub gin, Ricky Addington.
Is that what I am? I'll take it.
It's Aragorn. It's the Return of the King. I said I was going to do it. It is Lord of the Rings reference number one for tonight.
The heir of Isildur. I will take it.
And the Duke of Down Under, Adam Camilleri.
Well, this will be one of the more variety openings to the show. It's the Variety Hour with Paul Murphy, Ricky Addington, and Adam Camilleri.
So it's got a good energy.
We have
a couple of segments to introduce this week. I've got a community spotlight segment with Battlehaven coming up and with Pablo Martinez from the Frontline Gaming Network.
The Rhino, the PTPPPP Pob himself.
So great segments. This segment with us, I want to talk about how to play when you're down. I want to talk about, when you roll up to the table and say you brought an assault army and then you get matched up against a clearly better assault army. We don't have to focus this just on assault, but when you've brought a trick to the table and then you get paired up against someone who has a better trick, does your trick better, what do you do?
You start drinking and hope that they're friendly.
Well, firstly, you ask the eagles to take you to Mordor instead of walking like an idiot.
Look, we know the eagles only get you part of the way there. They will drop you off intentionally several thousand miles away from where you're supposed to go.
Everyone knows that Gwalior had better things to do. Get it together.
Totally did. Okay? It was like following moths. All his moth mates were just like, nah, mate, we've got this massive light over here. We're just going to chase that for a bit. And he's like, yeah, fair enough. Fair enough, guys. Okay. But as for playing when you're down, I actually really like this topic. So I think that with the granularity of the power of the game at the moment, and I've been noticing this a little bit more. There's a lot more. There used to just be this big gap between what's the best thing and what's the next best thing, and now there's a lot of steps in the middle now. I suppose that's one of the strengths of what 8th edition has brought. Well, so you know, we used to see 6th edition was Tauda, yeah. There was Tauda, and then there was this massive, massive cliff similar to the Grand Canyon, and then there was all the bottom feeding armies that weren't Tauda. 7th edition at the end of it was the same. You had Riptide Wing, you had the Bark Star, you had Centurion Stars, you had Screamer Councils, all these other things, and then you had this big cliff, and there was everything else. There's not that much of that now. There is a huge gap between things like the Brohammer list, which now, thankfully, has taken a huge shot in the face, and we can all praise the Omnissiah for that bad boy.
And we haven't talked about the Space Marine FAQ. Sooner or later, it's like, you wait by the river and the fact will come for all of us. That's how it is, right? So we should talk a little bit about that later on in the show, but yes.
Mm. But so now with the granularity in the game, there is a lot more stepping stones between what is competitive and what is uncompetitive there. And there's a lot of things in the middle now. There's not just those two binary ones and zeros. There's a lot of point ones and point zeros and whatever. You think about things like, Tau was a good example prior to maybe where they are now. You had the Richard Siegler Tau build, which was the obvious best build they had. And then they had like a crap load of builds in the middle. Some of them had 9 broadsides. Some of them just had, 3 riptides and then some, hammerheads, or had all the hammerheads and what are the ones called with the missiles? They had the mech ones. They did all right for a little bit. I think Devin Swan. Yeah, and then had the flyers and all those things. And there was a lot of granularity within the middle of what the best list was and then what the semi-competitive things were. And so what we're talking about here is, let's say you are playing something that's pretty semi-competitive, that's good, it's good, but there's an obvious better thing and you just happen to run into it.
Yeah, so it's a better thing because another army does it a little bit better. That's it. So you're playing, Blood Angels, and I'll relate this to me, is that Blood Angels are really good at assault. And sometimes you just come up against a better assault trick, where it's like perilous to engage them in the way that you would like to play the game. So how do you change it up?
Yeah, well, so a good example for Blood Angels was back in the day when Chaos was a big deal. You'd have to, you have your big Sangard bomb or your Death Company bomb, and you have to try and put that into the plague bearers to push through to the characters. And a lot of the time, you didn't manage it, especially if they double layered. And then what happened then was you got countercharged from reserve by 20 bloodletters, and you all get mushed. And so it's not quite. Yeah, like you said, they've got a better combat trick.
Back in the day, I would come up against Space Wolves all the time, and it used to really just wind me up that Space Wolves were consistently better at assaulting than I was.
That's a real thing. I think probably the shooting phase is where we're going to find the best talking points for this. And because the shooting, actually, there's a lot of granularity in the combat as well, actually.
Well, I think because there's some similarities for when you start to, like, how you defeat this. How do you battle against this is that you do start to use things like the range bands and terrain and stuff. So I think there's similarities in how you deal with both, and you focus on scoring the mission, of course. I mean, that's a given, right? Some of the things that we take as our score, our objectives, or how we approach winning the game is by engagement. And I think we've got to learn how to take that foot off the gas. We talked about last week how, you know, discipline and defense wins championships, but how do you actually mount a defense?
Yeah. So there's a lot of different, I think this is a really big facet and topic, and I like that a lot because it gives me a lot of a broad brush to make sweeping generalizations that are probably most.
Let's just talk about what all players do and what all people think. Let's just talk about that.
Game at the same time, what happens?
We're going to be 100% correct every time about what they think. I mean, I'm kidding, of course. So let's keep take everything we say in a perspective of what, you know, anybody's listening, their army might be.
So, okay. So let's break this down really, really to the core of things. So in the combat phase, the strength of the combat phase is who gets to hit first, whether that be by you get the charge off naturally, you get the first turn of activation, you get the 2CP interrupt, or if your codex has another version of that, or you have a version of making someone fight last, e.g. like the Vexator Mask for Dark Eldar. And when you said before, you twigged this in my head when you said before the rules of it, like the terms of engagement, the combat phase lives and dies by the term of engagement, which is why things like Death Company always kind of retain this huge, fearsome Alpha Strike presence, because they have they go first and they have the terms of engagement. They have the opportunity to have those, which is why Master of Ambush just got nerfed as well, because it was such an oppressive use of that, you know, I get the terms of engagement.
It was a better Forlorn Fury because it worked on Centurions.
Exactly, because it was freaking Centurions. Yeah. So, but if I'm playing against a much better list, yeah, and let's say we're players of equal standing, I'm not looking to stop that guy from charging me. Most likely that guy is, his army is better because it's going to better control the rules of engagement, the terms of engagement. Because if you look at very powerful combat units, yeah, most likely whoever gets the charge is going to crush the other one. Things like fighting twice back to pack, like berserkers do, or like knights can do, or things like transhuman can skew this one way or another. But generally speaking, the powerful melee unit that gets the charge is going to wipe out the other powerful melee unit. Now, that means that you have to not let your powerful melee unit get fed to the other one. So therefore, you need to control the rules of engagement, or at least control where they connect. And that comes to screaming. That comes to being very good at zoning in your areas of control. And that comes to, let's say, I've got a Bulgrim unit. A Bulgrim unit isn't good at killing a Centurion unit, but it's all I freaking got as an answer for a Centurion unit. But so all I need to do is make sure that the Centurion unit comes down and charges something else, so the Bulgrim actually have an opportunity to make contact with them on their terms. Because if it's the other way around, the Bulgrim don't even get to swing. They just get wiped to a man by a six-man Centurion unit. And that's my best example, because that's the one I've tackled with the most in my head. So what I need to do is make sure that I have things available for those Centurions to kill when he wants them to kill something. Whether I have to actually feed them like an artillery piece. I have to have a basilisk just waving out in the air and say, here's a free basilisk. Yeah. Please take it. I want you to have it, because I need the whole game hinges on me being able to connect with your big bully unit on my terms.
You brought up the Vexator Mask there as well. So that's an example of, if all I have is this charging unit and it gets near your Vexator Mask, then me charging doesn't matter. And exactly, if I've got a glass cannon charger, then I need to know that. Well, I mean, I will know that. I'll know that because you communicate with your opponent of what they've brought.
That's just the basis. That's just the basics of the game. I'm sure that's no surprise to anybody. I'm not like doing a big educational spiel here, but where it gets more nuanced and a lot more of it. So there's a huge amount of nuance in the fight phase. But shooting is a whole different head miles and miles and miles of thinking in the shooting phase. Because you've got range, you have things that need line of sight, don't need line of sight, you have things that have different potencies, different ranges, e.g. Plasma, melter, rapid fire in general. You have things that can shoot you, so things that can move 60 inches and then shoot. You have things that can only move 4 inches but can shoot, you know, can double move, triple move and then shoot, things like that. You have things like paladins that shoot in the freaking psychic phase now.
Shooting, though, I think is a little bit more straightforward in the thought process. Can they see me? Can they not see me? Do they have range? Do they not have range? Can I skirt cover? Can I get in range? Can I somehow blank their turn? And that's what we're going to see a lot more, I think, going forward after this, you know, post FAQ, is that a lot of the potency is taken out of some of these armies after turn one of the game.
Yeah.
And well, so they definitely did that for Dark Angels. So good job, G-Dubs.
I know, man. How does it feel to be an accidental casualty of an FAQ, Ricky?
I'm okay. I'm actually okay with it. And the reason I'm okay with it is because I feel like doctrines are now going to play how they should play. You know, the whole intent is that Marines are this – you know, Marines have these doctrines that they're going to come down, they're going to hit hard with their heavy weapons, they're going to move in with their mid-range, and then they're going to assault. And that's how it should have been. So, yeah, does it screw me over and I lose, like, my ability after turn one? Yeah, it does. But I think on the whole, it plays more thematically, and I think it's going to be a more fun and dynamic experience. And I think the game itself will be better for it. And I think lists will adjust and people will move on.
Of course. But we're still going to run into these situations to where people are geared towards one phase of the game or the other, shooting phase being one of them. And so it's easy for certain armies. Some armies are just better at shooting. Like Eldar are really good at high damage, you know, low point investment for a good damage, good AP.
Yeah.
Or a good volume of fire. I mean, they can basically do a lot of shooting. The Dark Eldar, all the Eldari races run into that kind of situation. And Guard, too.
Yeah, I've been playing, 20 years? I've been playing Dark Angels 20 years. I'm still trying to figure out what we're good at, but I'm sure there's something.
You get to be briefly good at things.
Yeah.
And then have it. And then when somebody else gets better at it, they take yours away, too.
Yeah, it's like, this rule is abusive. No, it's abusive for those guys. We don't have that rule. Like, you're just punishing us. I feel like the kid in class, you know, the kid in class who's not bothering anybody. He's not a bully. He's not a smart. He comes in, he does his work. He's diligent. He plugs away. And then some goober, you know, shoots a spit wad into the class, and that everybody gets punished for it. That's the Dark
Angels. Nobody can bring straws anymore, so the kid can't drink his drink.
Iron Hands shot a spit wad at the teacher, and now Dark Angels gets no recess.
So, Adam, what were you going to say?
I was going to say, Ricky, I am a Dark Angels player too, and I feel you, man. But you know, so as much as I feel fear for us Dark Angels boys, I've got this fear that because of these nerfs, like Space Wolves are not going to get out of the gate. They're just going to be like a limp fish.
No, they're totally not. And they are going to get it. I mean, those guys can't win. Come on. Is there anything worse than being a Blood Angels, a Dark Angels, a Space Wolves player right now?
Hey, I'm not gonna sabotage.
Yeah, what is? And you roll up to the table, and somebody goes, "Oh, great, another Marine army," and you're like, "Dude, I'm with you on this. I'm not those Marines." So I feel like for a while we've been paying the price for the other Marines, you know. And so
I've never even had a chance to destroy the meta. We didn't have a chance to destroy guys. Like,
but you know what? I don't care. I will take this one on the chin because
you guys won one tournament 2 weeks ago.
No. What was it like? Six Raven Wing Jets won a tournament. That's not Dark Angels. That's the thing that gets me.
You can't say that though.
I know
I played that Dark Angels list. I took it to a team event. I talked about it on the show last week. I played three games with that same list with the new changes the weekend just gone. I was just going to tell the people out there, it's actually fine. It actually still works just fine. It's still oppressively oppressive turn one. And you still have that wall, you have that Warlord trait you can purchase to have a second turn of Dev Doctrine in the 6-inch bubble once per game. And so you just turn that on. And I, like, all my games were decided turn two, and then turn three, four, five was mop up. So it actually functions exactly the same. I didn't want to burst anyone's bubbles. And G-Dub, don't nerf it. I like that Warlord trait. Yeah, it's, look, it's just fine. And I think the game is actually in a far, far better place. The fact is, like, Ultramarines now look really good. And I like that. Ultramarines are cool.
Yeah, Gilliman's, I was just talking
Gilliman's
about
a punk. Gilliman's an absolute punk. Like, stuff him. And Kalgar's all right. Togirius, he's okay. Kato Sicarius, that guy can burn, die in a fire. I've got no time for that guy. He's a bitch.
getting us slightly back on topic with, like, you come up and we're talking about the shooting phase. I know this is a faceted topic, like you said. The shooting phase, I think you have to be prepared to give up some of your, I guess, your bloodlust, your thirst for getting kill points in the early part of the game if you're coming up against a better shooting army. I think you have to have that restraint to not expose yourself to losing your pieces before you get to interact with them coming up against a more shooty army.
Yeah, that's the thing is, like, if you don't try to outdo the guy who is clearly better at you, like, don't try to outshoot the better shooting army. Deny him the better shooting. Your tactic shouldn't be, well, I hope I get really lucky and he doesn't.
Yeah, if you're relying on luck, yeah.
So I think of the fight phase, I think of combat as more like a puzzle, like a game of checkers, not quite as chess, like the whole game of 40K is more like chess. But just the fight phase is like a puzzle. I'm trying to put the right pieces together, get the right things in the right spots for wrapping or pylons and consolidate to tap things and all this stuff. I think of the shooting phase as a checklist. Am I in range? Tick. Am I in line of sight? Tick. Do I have the appropriate weapon for the target? Tick. Do I have enough resources to dedicate to do the amount of damage I hope to do? Tick, cross. And, you know, if you can put crosses in any of those for your opponent, you know, take the things that you don't want to lose first turn, take them out of range. Like, let them kill things you can afford to lose, if anything. Because, you know, a lot of the times you can't hide all the things you want to hide in a game. Like, can the guy's weapons that he has that are really good against me, can he kill the things that I've given him? Like, let's say he's spamming las cannons, yeah? I've only got two tank commanders. I'll hide both tank commanders. You are more than welcome to shoot las cannons into my infantry squads. I'll even double move them into your face, so you have to.
But, that's a great point. I mean? That's a very great point.
Yeah, so it's a checklist. You go down your checklist and you're like, okay, where can I mess with this guy's checklist?
Well, also trying to present him with some tasty alternatives to hopefully maybe force, you know, a mistake. I mean, mistake is a relative word, right? But trying to mess with his target priority.
Absolutely. Me and my other WTC guys, I'm for Team Australia, we talk about this concept called knowledge disparity. So there's so much knowledge you need to know how your opponent's army works now. You've got codexes, FAQs, specialist attachments, psychic awakenings, chapter approved. You've got so many things you need to take into account. Sometimes you might think you are the underdog in a matchup and there's like one or two little pieces of tech that you don't pull out, like in your little tool bag that you don't need any other time, but all of a sudden it's a game winner in this one situation. I mean, having a thorough understanding of where your army fits in a cohesive, like, competitive pyramid. Like, think about the food pyramid. You know, you got your grains at the bottom, then you got your protein and your dairy and all that stuff. Yeah, the competitive 40K pyramid. I want to see memes of the competitive 40K pyramid. That'd be fantastic. But if you, like, you need a realistic expectation of what you're going to be able to accomplish in a game. So, like, I was in, so 2 weeks ago at this team tournament I went to, I took those Dark Angels flyers. I had the wrong expectation. I played into a guy who had, I think he had about 100 ignoring minus two sisters bodies. And my expectation at the start of that game prior to the event was when I rated the score in that game, I might get a slight win, might get a slight loss. Because it depends on the mission, because if it's a big progressive scoring mission, he has all the board control, he could run away with the scoreboard, and then I'm trying to catch it up later because of, you know, how many bodies he has and how resilient they are against me. Turns out I was completely wrong. Like, the knowledge disparity of how my list worked, functioned against him was completely entirely wrong. I wiped that guy in two turns. I actually tabled him in two turns through 100 sisters' bodies ignoring minus two. It didn't matter. I had that so many shots. But that's what I mean. Like, having a proper understanding of where your army fits into the scheme of things is really, really important if you're going to be able to contend with things that are more powerful than you.
That's a great point. Knowing all those little nooks and crannies of your stratagems or your warlord traits. That's another big thing. Like there's some warlord traits that we often consider to be absolutely utterly useless because they don't fit into what our plan is when we're making our army list. But when you roll up the table, opportunities may present themselves.
Exactly right. I've been looking at Imperial Knights a little bit. Man, that book is like the granularity in that book is huge. So one thing that there's actually like, apart from the House Raven stratagem, I don't think there's anything in that book that actually interacts with the wound dice. Apart from like the reroll the harpoon automatically gets against vehicles and stuff. There's actually nothing in there that interacts with the wound dice. You can't get +1 to wound, -1 to wound. You can't reroll wounds, like apart from the rerolling ones, like I said, on the House Raven strat. But there's like House Camdis, which I've never even heard of before. Like I didn't even know it existed until I bought the code.
That's a funny point. As soon as you started thinking that, I was like, there are some houses that I have no idea what they do.
So yeah. one thing that I didn't think knights could do, I didn't think there was any way that knights could ignore cover. But this House Camdis has a relic that ignores cover. Either it's a relic or a warlord trait. And so you can take a crusader and everything on it ignores cover, which is really good, especially against space marines who, you know, they're stacking the stealthy trait and stuff. And some Eldar lists as well. And so I was looking, oh, is there a way I can get a knight to ignore cover? Because that could be really helpful in like a pairings process in the team's thing. Because people might not see it. They're like, oh, knights have no way to ignore cover. Haha, here's my crusader who ignores cover. Everything's dead. It's fantastic. And so like that's what I mean about the knowledge disparity. I had no idea that existed. I had to buy the codex and put it next to my toilet. And then I found out it existed. By the way, that's where I do all my 40K learning.
Either that's the library. Yeah.
Just make sure everyone's clear. Don't ever ask to see his codex. So like... You know, just Google it or something. That's the important thing.
We call that the Omega Vault.
Yeah.
I'm going to go home and I've got this pot of typhus corrosion paint, you know, the gritty. I'm going to spill some of that on my codexes and I'm going to bring it.
Don't worry about that.
People are going to be like, I heard you on Forge Narrative. I'm like, do you want to see my rules? And they're going to be like, no. It's going to be great.
And on that note, let's take a quick break. Then we'll come back. I have a community spotlight segment. Then after that, we'll come back with us, and then we'll take another break.
Quality programming.
All right, we'll see.
Top shelf.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to a community spotlight segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul. I'm joined tonight by Chris Morgan.
Hey.
And Sarah Hollingshead and Mike Dunn from Battlehaven.
Hey, great to be here.
Yo, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us again.
Yeah, absolutely. So Battlehaven's coming up May 5th this year.
That's correct.
Going to be jam-packed with stuff. Tell us what's going on.
Well, it's May 5th through May 9th, so we're super excited to be back again and have all of our great friends and new friends coming out. And it's just going to be a great event. Great time of year to be out here in the mountains.
If people want to follow along during this segment, they can go to battlehaven.us, see some pictures, see some of the stuff we're talking about, and just kind of get a feel during this segment.
Yeah, that's great. There's a lot of information on there. And they can also reach out with any questions directly to myself or Mike through battlehavenevents@gmail.com.
We've talked about it before, but anybody that may not have heard about it, this is a... like a gaming resort, a gaming week getaway, almost kind of like a landlocked cruise.
Absolutely. It is so much fun. It's at a beautiful resort, 20 acres, private resort that we rent. So it's gorgeous on-site amenities and nestled in the mountains of Utah in a beautiful location, private lake and all the fun things in a great cabin. So it is just awesome. Plus, we have a chef that comes out and does all of our meals. So every meal is included, and they're amazing.
I'd say that's one of my favorite parts of it.
That's why I mentioned people should go check out the pictures while we're talking, because they can see pictures of the resort, pictures of some of the meals and stuff, the theme meals that I'm sure we'll talk about here in a second. It's a sight to behold.
It really is. There's a lot of great pictures on there, and it just doesn't even do it justice. You got to be there to really experience the whole feeling.
If you go to the website, you'll see some pictures of the lodge. So the lodge looks really nice. And you can see there's some windows on the upper floors. But if you look out the windows in the upper floors, like around sunset time, and you see like the beautiful orange, purple, blue sunsets on the clouds, a nice cool breeze, and you think, does it get any better than this? And the answer is no. No, it doesn't. Because once that's done, you you're inside looking at this, right? You go downstairs and you can just keep rolling dice. Like, that's how many times do you get to do something like that? Not many.
No, and it's the perfect setting. And there's no unlimited on the gaming. That just goes pretty much until people are done, as early as they'd like to start and as late as they'd like to go. Just with interruptions of amazing food and other experiences, because there's a lot to do. There's a lot to do when you want to take a little bit of a break and just hang out.
Well, we mentioned the gaming, but you've got plenty of tables set up, some that are dedicated, or at least positioned for 40K. But it's not just that. There's a lot of 40K, a lot of GWS stuff going on. But you've got, you know, tell me about some of the other games.
I think we've got 12 tables set up with beautiful terrain, and we always switch it out every couple of days, and the players are welcome to switch it out depending on what games they're playing. But as you said, we've got 40K, Age of Sigmar, X-Wing, a lot of Frostgrave, Rangers of Shadowdeep. We've got a ton of board game tables that are set up during the day. People can play all kinds of different board games. We've had a lot of fun playing Zombicide the last couple of years. We've got
Legion. Zombicide Night is like a busy night at Battlehaven. That table is packed.
Yeah, we'll be probably running more than one this year. We have a lot of enthusiasts.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, more than one. Yeah, basically any kind of miniatures game you can think of, we've hosted it at Battlehaven and had people enjoying it and learning the game. And Infinity has been a big one. We've got, I think, 3 Infinity tables ready to go this year. Yeah, the Star Wars games from Fantasy Flight Games, those are generally the big ones that we've got.
So are some of them structured events? Are people just there for open play? How does this how does the day progress for folks?
We have both that'll be going on. We'll have themes each day, which is really fun. This year we're switching up a little bit and even diving more deeply into the themes. And so that's going to be a lot of fun. So there will be instruction available for everything gaming, from specific games to hobby skills that we have people coming in and teaching. So there'll be a lot of things wrapped around there'll be a lot of options. Does that make sense? Wrapped around each theme each day. So there'll be a lot that people can do. We can set up more formal games based on interest. We reach out just about 6 weeks prior to the event and find out what people really want to do. And then we do our best to provide the things that are on the top of their list. So that will be structured, as well as just getting together and picking up games with all the great people that are there. And we always have the most amazing guests at Battlehaven.
You guys got some D&D going on this year?
That we do. We actually have 2 Dungeon Masters, if not more, that are going to be there running events throughout the whole week. That was a lot of fun. We embarked on that last year, but just on one day, and realized that was nowhere near enough. So we'll be running some beginning and more advanced campaigns, which I think will be a lot of fun.
It's funny because that one D&D game led to just somebody calling, like putting me in their phone contact as Pompous Paladin. I'm not exactly sure why.
I can't even imagine.
It's something that, you know, that was the persona that I was playing, apparently, whether I intended to or not. It was really fun. It was a really fun night of D&D.
That's awesome. I'm really excited for that. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. And for me, that was kind of my entry drug, so to speak, into gaming back when I was a kid. And D&D was I'm aging myself here, but D&D was pretty new and I was just a kid. And I think I was 11 when I first played it. And it was so much fun. And it kind of started a love for all kinds of different kinds of games, strategy games and stories and just being involved in that kind of thing. So I think I'm not the only person that has that kind of memory or has played actively with D&D. So no, we're excited to have that.
Actual practical use of math.
Exactly, which is exactly why we were playing it at that age. It was a teacher who was teaching us some new skills. So it was really fun.
No, that's neat. It's certainly made a resurgence. Like, gaming in general has made a resurgence in the last, you know, few years or so, and doesn't seem to be slowing down. So
no.
It's really neat because a lot of people don't get the opportunity to play different types of games, you know, in their normal day-to-day life. You know, it's either because they don't know the group of people they can get together to play that different type of game, or they just don't have time in their life to have 2 or 3 games in a day. But the event like Battlehaven is a pretty strong opportunity to get out and try that.
It really is. You're immersed, right? You got to do it as a retreat. It's the best way to play. in my opinion.
Time, it's the vacation. You get up, you can game at 6, 7 in the morning if you wanted to. Game till 6 o'clock in the morning if you want to.
And all of that is and has been the way it goes.
Yeah. Well, it's fun because like my wife and I have been looking forward to Battlehaven pretty much since the last Battlehaven ended. This last weekend, we decided we were going to pull the trigger on an Age of Sigmar army for my wife, and she wanted to do some Oryx, so we got one of the big Maw Crushers and a get start collecting box, and we've undertaken a hobby challenge to get that all painted and ready so that she can roll with her Oryx at Battlehaven. So it's one of those things that like as it gets closer and closer, we just get more and more excited about it.
That's great. I'm excited to see her army all finished and beautiful.
We talk about destination events on the show a lot, but this is actually a destination event. Like you get to go someplace in a really scenic and beautiful area and spend a weekend kind of embroiled in whatever your thing is.
It's the very best way of doing it, in my opinion. A lot of fun. You mentioned in a beautiful scenic area, and this is nestled right in the mountains of Utah. In fact, you one side of the resort is red rocks, and then the scenery just wraps out to a vista of mountains and private lake that we have there that we use. It's just beautiful. It's just a beautiful setting, and yet you can be inside and see all of it through the beautiful windows and the decks. There's a heated full-size pool and very large hot tub that we utilize every day, as well as great things on the inside. We've got movies, movie theater, billiards, etc.
So there's a few different ways people can experience this. They can either stay on-prem in the lodge, which hopefully they're looking at pictures of it right now, or you guys are partnered with a hotel that's close by that makes it even kind of maybe more economical or more affordable to people if either they can't make it because the reservations are booked on-prem or that's a consideration and they still want to make it out.
Absolutely. And it's really convenient. It's just right down the road, a beautiful, very short drive. And they've given us a great rate. And so the very best economical way to do that would be to mention Forge the Narrative and get a 10% discount just for mentioning. So that's pretty awesome. That's a significant amount off of your ticket. And then you can do on site. We've got a couple more. Second Lieutenant, which is a bunk in a shared room. And we have one First Lieutenant, which is a queen size bed in a shared room. And then our reserves passes are the staying off site passes. Whether you live locally close by and just want to drive in or stay with a friend or stay at this hotel, which is really great. And if you come with a group, you split the hotel rate per night, which is only $99 per night. And that could be split between 2, 3 or more people if you wanted. Making it even more economical.
If I remember right from the last time we talked, that hotel is like recently renovated too.
It's a brand new hotel. It's the newest in Heber. So it's really nice.
Yeah.
And they've been great.
You still get the scenery. The scenery doesn't go anywhere no matter where you stay. No.
It's beautiful. It's all right there.
Yeah. I can definitely see the value of wanting to stay on site too, to kind of, again, have that, that bunk case you want to crash during the middle of the day to be able to stay up for that 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, like we were just talking about.
Yes. It's so fun to be on site. But you do get the full experience. If we're sold out, of the on site rooms or what work fits for you. Offsite's a great option too, because you can come early in the morning. You're there for all the meals, and leave late at night. So it works both ways. But I agree with the onsite. It's the best. We have a few spots left. We'd love to have some people, more people join us there.
And let's talk about this food. The food. I mean, you mentioned bringing a chef in for the weekend, but it's a little bit more than that.
Yes, our chef is a gamer himself, and so he's thoroughly excited about this. He's been with us now. This will be his third Battlehaven that he'll be doing. And so, guys, do you want to attest to the quality of the food?
It is fantastic. I have never eaten so well, so consistently in my entire life.
It's delicious and it's flexible. So like you have a wide variety of things to choose from. I mean, for people who care, there's one attendee who's a vegan. There's food for him. There's something for everybody to eat, and it's all prepared really well. You can pretty much never have too much of it. I don't think we've ever run out of food at any of the meals that we've done.
We've run out of stomach themes.
Yes, that is an unfortunate truth right there. Is just not enough room to eat all of the things. And then, you know, the last year we capped it off with this nice, like kind of professionally served, like 3 or 4 course meal with the dessert and everything. Tables were all decorated with nerdy things all over. It's the perfect comfortable space for, you know, a supreme geek like myself.
It's a lot of fun. We really enjoy it, and the food's delicious. And we are theming. I said, mentioned earlier that we're doing a little bit more with the themes and diving in a little deeper. So each day will be themed. That will be decor throughout the day, as well as some of the movies we'll be playing in the theater, as well as some of the games that we'll be doing demos and instruction for. And Mike, did you want to mention a couple of those just for fun?
The instruction is always something that draws a big crowd. We've had all kinds of different classes from modeling and assembly, different ways to use different materials to convert and customize your models. The scenic bases is always really popular. We always have classes on beginning airbrushing, advanced airbrushing, stuff about weathering. I've been learning a ton about weathering this year, so I'm excited to teach that. Been using oil paints and enamels and jumping in headfirst into all of that wonderful world of art supplies besides acrylics.
Heck yeah. Yeah, it opens up a whole new thing for you.
Yeah, it's awesome. So I'm excited to share that. The themes, let's see, what have we got? Kind of a 40K, like a grimdark future theme. And then we'll have some movies to go along with that and food that fits the theme. We've got a fantasy theme. We've got a future theme that kind of centers around Infinity and Star Wars, more of the
sci-fi sort of.
Yeah, sci-fi.
We have a game all out game.
Oh, that's right.
Night, which will be, you know, all the board games and card games and just a lot of new things. We have a one of our team coming out, a business coming out that they create games. So they'll also be doing a lot of demos with new games that you probably have never played before that are a lot of fun.
Oh, that sounds awesome. Yeah. Are people invited to bring their own games, like from home and stuff with them as well?
Absolutely. We will reach out and see what people are interested in and then be able to make sure we have plenty of people that want to and are able to and excited to play those games or to learn them. You can bring games from home. You can request others. We try to get everything that we can get that's requested, make sure that it's available. And we're usually really pretty successful with that. So
that's
great.
I can just imagine folks that may be like, man, you know, I really want to play this board game, but haven't cracked it open yet. You know, what a better opportunity.
That's right. We have a lot of people that are very skilled in a wide variety of great board games, too. So it'll be great opponents. And it's about the fun. And it's about the sportsmanship. And one of the really fun things that we do is peer voted awards we're paying attention throughout the week. And at the end of the week, those are given out on our final night. That's a lot of fun too. So we really promote just having that great sportsmanship, getting involved and having a good time with each other.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, guys, if they have not already checked it out, go to battlehaven.us. That's all one word, .us. What's that email address again?
battlehavenevents@gmail.com.
Mike, Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us this week.
Thank you. It's so great to be here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Chris, we'll talk to y'all soon.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Hey, we'll see you.
See ya.
FTN is also on Facebook. Please like us at www.facebook.com/ForgeTheNarrative.
We are back. This is Paul here. I got the Goof Troop.
Yeah, that's pretty accurate, actually.
Well,
we
just had a community spotlight segment, and we're talking about how to play when you're outgunned or outclassed or out anything, like when your trick has been come over the top by another army or another opponent. Like, what do you do? You know, and obviously you got to use things that are not especially germane to your list. Like if you were planning on, like, it's easy for me, man, I got a bunch of damage 2 power swords. I'm going to run over there and just chop, chop, you know? I mean, it's easy to get broken down into that linear thinking. That's not even bad either. Like you can win a lot of games by having a consistent plan every single time. And you might even get lucky. I mean, we do roll the dice, right? But I'm thinking about, like, this is, we're also not solving the problem right now either. I'm not trying to solution this for anyone, but I'm just trying to inject stuff into the consciousness about what to think about when you do roll up against things like this, because you're going to see it. We have some lopsided matchups in the game right now.
Hugely lopsided. Like, you think about you can't say poor old GSC, but you think about GSC playing into like Centurions. There's no good options for them to tackle that issue.
I've had lots of comments recently about people that their Genestealer cults just can't even play against power armor right now.
Yeah, it's because they've got like these three layers of stopping you. So ideally, like a Genestealer cult work on the thing of, oh, you've got two units next to each other. I'm going to come in. I'm going to come D6 inches closer than nine. I'm going to charge you, rerollable. I'm going to kill one of them, wrap the other. The problem is the other unit you wrap is like five scouts with combat weapons that kill 2/3 of your unit, of your expensive Rockshaw unit in return. So there's no good, you just like the scouts are supposed to be the crappy ones. They're like, okay, cool. I kill the intercessors, wrap the scouts. Oh, the scouts butchered me. Fantastic. Oh, and they get to fight first next time. And they shot me with bolt pistols before they fought next time. Oh, cool. So I just traded, there was five scouts and five intercessors here and my Rockshaw bomb. And I traded them all for five intercessors. Oh, fantastic. This feels good. That's not including
all those 40 models you just painted. You just assembled and painted.
Yeah. That costs a horrendous amount of physical dollars. Yeah. And then you've got Auspex scans to handle. You've got infiltrators to deal with. You've got Overwatch, like Centurion or Aggressor Overwatch, just like destruction. On top of that, Iron Hands just overwatching you on fives or fours if they're
fours.
Strategy.
Fours is the brutal. Like, yeah. It's worth it. Like, if you're planning a Genestealer cult, they have the tools. And I don't want to sidetrack us on that. Like, that's what we're talking about. Like, your shtick is doing this, and they're like, wait, you get to shoot almost as if it was just your shooting phase. This is like, does not seem great. Yeah. How do I?
I just need to point out, guys, Dark Angels used to get to do that.
I know. That was our thing. That was the thing that we did. Lion's Blade Strike Force. Remember that? That was our Decurion detachment.
So good. Yeah. Do you know how many Razorbacks I painted in a week? all of them, guys. Spoiler alert, it was all of them.
But were they Las Plaz, hey? Were they Las Plaz?
No, they were just all assault.
Yes, fair. So, but for like an example for Genestealer Cult, yeah, Genestealer Cult used to be this massively surgically oppressive combat army. But now, like, I've had some very good players. Like Eric Clitheros is one of the best players I've ever met. He came in a second or third at CanCon, which is like the biggest tournament in Australia, using mono Genestealer Cult. And he had only like one or two combat units, and the rest of it he diversified into massing mining lasers and webbers. He decided, okay, my army is not just a combat army because of how flexible it is with the deployments and the going back in reserve and coming from reserve and moving around and double and all these crazy things. He's like, okay, I'm pivoting my army from being this crazy surgical oppressive combat army into this amazingly dynamic hybrid combat and board control army with like decent shooting. And so you diversify. So if you're not the best, if your army and the thing you dedicate, the thing you love is not the best in slot, like it's not the best on the totem pole pyramid of 40k goodness, diversified into other things. And one of my big tips will be always pay for an extra relic or two and always get an extra warlord trait if you can, just so you can like modify it to the matchup. So if you are down in power, like, so Dark Angels is a good example. Dark Angels have a Eye of the Unseen, I think, or Eye of whatever, and it's enemy characters within 3 inches have to fight last.
Yeah, love it.
I play against Blood Angels and I'm like, I am taking that because your Smash Captains now can't come into this 3-inch denial zone where I put Samael and 2 Talon Masters into it. Like, so here's my 3 things I don't want to get touched by a Smash Captain. All 3 of those things have a decent chance of killing that Smash Captain, especially if they all get the Heroic Intervene on you. And making you strike last means that you actually can't put that guy in there. Like, he's just suicide. And so things like that, where I'm like, Blood Angels demolish Dark Angels in combat. Like, just it's not even a thing. But if I get to use the tools that I've purchased, so Sammy is quite good in combat. He's not as good as Smash Captain, but he kills a Smash Captain if he gets to strike first, you know, most of the time. On those terms, like, plusing that relic means that all of a sudden my combat is more relevant than yours. It's not better, but it's more relevant because I get to use mine.
I like that. I also like what you said about if you're playing in an environment where you have to like pre-spend all your pre-game command points, then go ahead and investing in those if you feel like you're going to run into those matchups more often than not. And sometimes because of your codex choice, you will go ahead and invest in those extra pregame things like an extra warlord trait or relic or whatever, just to give you your flexibility to adjust to that kind of stuff on the fly.
Because, yeah, the best thing you can do is if you're not taking some super skewed, like if you're not taking Centurions, yeah, if you want to take a combat army that's good, but it's not Centurions or it's not Blood Angels, then take one that's good enough to contend and then diversify your toolbox. Because there's in straight line power, you're just not as good, yeah? I don't think anybody's delusional about saying that, Orcs are still the combat powerhouse army that they always were. They're not. They're nowhere near, but taking a bunch of the different psychic powers, taking a couple of the different, like taking some goth unit, Ardboid goth units, maybe that tilt things in your favor, like math wise, like do some math, see where the crux points come between you winning a combat and losing a combat if you get the charge versus some of these other bull units. Cause, that is the strength of Orcs. You have so many units, you can throw one away. Like I can throw away 30 boys and maybe I get to Green Titan, maybe I don't, as long as I get this other 30 unit.
Yeah,
of 30
I
was boys,
saying, you throw away 28 exactly boys. Saying.
Exactly right. 28 boys and 2 CP and then 3 more CP to bring them all back.
That's
but you
fine.
Started with you, but you started with 18, so who cares? Yeah. The bucket's not even half empty.
No, I like what you're saying. Again, not trying to really solution this, because I think that with the complexity of the game that you're going to have to come about it differently. But I think we all find those situations to where we have either a codex or an army that we play. Like, heck, our man Chris Morgan, he played with Blood Angels, in the lean times.
Mm-hmm.
And found ways to still go 4-1, 3-2, 3-0 and stuff,
Red Powell, he was on last week. He's notorious for just dedicating himself to playing like one style of thing and perfecting it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's his shtick.
Yeah. I completely agreed. Like those are things that, so it is possible. You have to be one to recognize how to play a little bit cagey. We talk about that a lot, but what we mean by this is, using the things that aren't just the stats of your model to win the game.
Yeah. So there's, at the start, I talked about a thing called, granularity. There's a little more granularity between armies and power levels at the moment, and even in different builds within factions. And then deeper than that, there's units, like how good you can make a unit. I think one of the biggest ceilings on a unit right now is Grey Knight Paladins, yeah? Like the granularity between how good they are when you put them on the table and then how good you can make them. There's such a, like you can put enough buffs on that unit that it kills pretty much anything, either shooting or combat.
Yeah, for extra shots, chance. Extra wounds, extra AP, things.
Yeah. The level of granularity where you can take that unit is phenomenal. But that's the thing, yeah. You need to know where to stop, because you have all these resources and they can go in all these different places. Piling them all onto the one thing to kill the one unit, to do the one job, isn't always the best choice. Knowing exactly, I need to give them, I need to have them in the tide. I need to have them with the +6 inches range and the ignoring negative modifiers, and then Psybolt them and they're done. I don't need to add on the other two or three other buffs. I could, because I can save those resources for later or put them into some strike units or blah, 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 blah. Everyone has as a actually always increasing like bucket of resources at the moment, especially with Psychic Awakening and all the crazy stuff coming out. And I mean, it's very easy to get stuck in that, I think, Death Star, nearly Death Star mentality of 7th edition, where it's like, oh, look how good I can make this thing. But you should be asking yourself, how good do I need to make this thing?
Yeah. Just to put it in the competitive or just over the edge or, min-max it.
Yeah. Plague Bearers were actually a really good example as well. Because there is a bunch of offensive buffs you could put on Plague Bearers, making them like damage 3 and doubling it with like the Relic Banner or some other crazy stuff. And all the extras to movement and advance, and then the Poo Tree and all those other things. And people were just like, we just need them to stand there and be -1 and -2 to hit. Cool. Sometimes a Warp Surgeon. That's
good
it.
Good point.
Everyone's just like, all right, cool.
That's a very
job
good
done. No, and so that's where it comes in with playing down into lists. Like, so maybe you can bait people into putting all their resources into their paladins or their centurions, and then isolating them with things like thunderfire cannons or half movement strats, running away and just letting them have wasted all these resources into something that you didn't mind them losing. Like you abandoned that flank as soon as you saw the matchup and you wanted them to come over there. And now you're just going to keep them thunderfired and do a bit of a bait and switch.
Excellent points. Let's take another break. We'll come back with another community spotlight segment, and then we will wrap up with these guys. See y'all in a minute.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey Hey, everybody. Welcome to a community spotlight segment on Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined this evening by Pablo Martinez.
What up?
Yo, man. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, dude, I want to have you on for your involvement in the community. I mean, you do a lot. You produce a podcast. You do a lot for FLG Frontline Gaming.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on once again. It's nice to be appreciated a little. However, Reese and Frankie are definitely the superstars of Frontline Gaming, and they absolutely do the most.
Well, I was impressed with your organization and a little bit of herding cats at the LVO. I know those things, you know, they don't run themselves, you know, and it takes a lot of organization and a lot of relationship building along the way. And you've been doing that through your involvement with them for quite some time.
Yeah, actually. So for anyone who's ever administrated or seen the back end of administrating a large convention, something like Nova or Adepticon, there's definitely a lot to there. There's a lot of moving parts. And I actually found out from Reese and Frankie about 3 months or 4 months before the LVO that I was going to be running it with them. And I didn't know if I was going to be prepared, but I was.
Well, you know, it's everyone's there, at least in that type of environment, to be part of, you know, kind of a communal cooperative experience, much like a 40K mm-hmm. game.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, once everyone gets kind of a rapport with each other, everyone really has their own system, right? They all show up and it's like any con. Everyone kind of knows where everyone is. Everyone knows what their plan is. Their buddies are all there. And for the most part, it can run itself. So as you get a lot bigger and as you scale up, people tend to be people and you know, go into these normal routines, which can help everything out a ton. I'm not saying that it's easy when you scale up by any means. There's always more difficulties. But that was one thing that I was kind of unexpected. Everyone just kind of did their own thing and they're like, oh, okay, you're Reese for this year. Cool. Well, I'll just go to you if I need something. Other than that, I'm going to do my own thing.
Well, in addition to that, you also run Chapter Tactics, the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely do. So for those of you who might not know, Chapter Tactics is a competitive 40K podcast. And what I mean by that is I don't give the hot takes on strategy tactics anymore. I'm just not as good of a player as Paul or Nick Nanavati or Richard Siegler. However, I focus on the competitive 40K side of the community. That is, I talk to tournament organizers. I get really good players on. I interview them. And that's primarily what Chapter Tactics was kind of built on, was the foundation of getting people into competitive 40K and showing people what it's like on the other side of tournaments, not the social side, not just the competition side and the playing side.
Yeah, that's really cool, man. I like that, the competitive spin on things, just to, I mean, as an effort to, people will play what they want to play, and I'm a big advocate of that too, but there's also, you know, there's a time investment, money investment type thing, and some people don't want to do all that experimentation themselves. They want to build off some of the knowledge and the wisdom and efforts of others, and that is completely okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're lucky to have this hobby be multifaceted. In terms of what you can do, you can take whatever you want out of it, or as little as you want out of it. You can read books, or you can fully immerse yourself in it. And within all of those different aspects of the hobby, we can build podcasts. So, and you're starting to see that now. You're starting to see podcasts spread up all over the place.
Yeah, that and exchange of ideas and stuff. I'm a mm-hmm. big fan of that hobby. Now, I obviously been doing it a while myself.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you still playing 40K? You still? I mean, it's easy to kind of the playing side starts to fade away as you become more on the organizer side.
Yeah. So there's this trope or this saying that I always thought was kind of overused by people, and that's if you work around something, you tend to get bored of it or you tend to get sick of it. And I always kind of scoffed at the like Magic pro players or chess world champions who are like, you know, I'm around this, it's kind of my job, and I'm kind of bored of it. I'm like, come on, it's an amazing job. Like you're playing chess or Magic or whatever, and you're constantly immersing yourself in this thing that you're passionate about. But that I've been doing 40K professionally in some way, with whether it's retail side or through the secondhand store, podcasting for, you know, 6+ years now, and I'm definitely feeling the 40K fatigue sometimes.
Well, that's kind of the neat thing, is that these models, you know, they'll wait on you. They'll wait on the shelf. It's like Toy Story, you know, they'll wait there and you get back and want to play with them again. It's all right.
Yeah, and one of the kind of really interesting things about it is also people's models will always stick around too. So 40K has a really active, thriving secondhand scene, and that's kind of how I got into it and also how I kind of re-energized myself. So I'm one of those weird people where every few years I get rid of my entire collection of something, or I just redo it and I take a different angle on a particular game. And for 40K, what I do is I sell maybe 80% of my models that I own, keep my special ones that have stories and mean a lot of sentimental value to me, and then just buy a new army or buy into something usually Imperium flavored, and then just go from there. And so I recently did that about a year and a half ago with 8th edition. And with the secondhand market, it's very, very easy to do in 40K, right? So you can just, these models, they don't disappear afterwards. They don't lose a ton of value after you paint them and after they've grown along or aged well. Not like Magic cards where, you know, cardboard has an expiration date if you don't take care of it. So, it definitely helps me get into the game. And obviously, I run the Frontline Gaming secondhand store. So I do have easier access to
the sweetest first picks of things.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's hard not to sometimes.
I understand. I completely understand. I've actually been getting into more of the skirmish games recently. Been playing a lot of Kill Team. I mean, I still play 40K. I got big tournaments coming up, practicing for and stuff, but I like the aesthetic of some of these skirmish game models. It's kind of cool to having like one foam tray of these kind of boutique looking models.
Oh yeah, I love that Kill Team, and I have actually some Kill Team. I've never played Kill Team, by the way. This is just something that I've collected in, but I will collect Kill Team. What are they called? Warbands? Teams? Kill Teams?
Yep. I assume they're called Kill Teams. The formal name probably Kill Teams.
but what I'll do is I'll see like, you know, 20 models that are painted really well by someone who sold them, and I'll pick them out and then buy them from the secondhand store. I'm like, okay, now I've got a Tyranid Kill Team. I'm probably never going to use it, but they look really cool.
Hey, so that's one of the things. Like Death, I love the Death Guard Marine aesthetics, and you know, the Marine models of Death Guard don't see a lot of play because it's just less advantageous to take them in the big game. But they're great in Kill Team, and there's a lot of art. There's a lot of figures that are that way. So if there's something that people are kind of excited about maybe buying and painting up and modeling, but they know they'll never use them in a game, there's probably an avenue in Kill Team for them.
Yeah, and actually, I think GW probably pushed Kill Team more. I was so excited when they came out with it officially, and especially when the TO or the playtesters who created this newest version of Kill Team, when they were announced, because they were a lot of, you know, veteran seasoned guys who knew what they were talking about, and they created a really good rule set. But the multiple format thing is very, very important for a game's health and longevity, right? If you take Magic, for example, they've got 4 or 5 eternal formats where cards that would normally be worthless in one format are, you know, $50-$60 cards in another format where they're really, really powerful. It's the same thing with 40K. If a Death Guard Poxwalker isn't good in Warhammer 40K, maybe it's good in Kill Team, and then that's where its value is. So you're still giving people incentive to go out and buy these models from a rules design perspective. Obviously, people buy models for the aesthetic and because the model looks cool, but let's face it, not all models are made the same. Vespids are ugly, but people might buy them if they're
good. Strong opinions here.
Yeah, I'm so sorry if you're a big Vespid. If you've got like your 500 Vespid painted in a Farsight scheme and you're just absolutely in love with that model, all three of you, I apologize.
I think we've hated on Vespids on this show for like 3 weeks in a row. It's all right.
I'm just, you know, following tradition.
Yeah, it's in the theme now. We may have to work it into every show. So you mentioned Magic. Do you play other games as well?
Oh, I play a lot of other games. I've always been drawn to the competitive side of any game or anything, really, whether, you know, it's tournaments or it's the competitive scene or, you know, community efforts, anything like that, in all states of it. I love the idea of competition. I love the camaraderie it brings. I love that people strive to be the best in their very specific things. And we are all such different human beings. We're all good at certain things. We're all good. Some of us aren't, you know, LeBron James. I'm never going to be good at the NBA. However, I might be good at something like chess, right? And so I love the idea of multiple avenues of competition for people to better themselves in. That's always been one of my driving life philosophies. So I try to play different games. I'm really into chess, Magic the Gathering, and League of Legends, along with 40K. I realized I kind of dodged your question a little bit earlier, but I am actually playing 40K games. I'm just joined the Las Vegas League. I've got some tournaments lined up for the next couple months, and I'm definitely going to jump back into it. And I know you guys are listening to this a little bit later, but the Space Marines just got nerfed, which is what I've been waiting for. Been waiting to see where they ended up before I really decided what I wanted to do. So hopefully because I think this wasn't even the April FAQ. This was just an emergency stopgap FAQ.
Yep. Yeah. That's the truth. Yep.
Yeah. So which is great. I want GW to do more of this. However, after the April FAQ is, I think, when I'll officially, jump into the season, whenever that is.
Yeah, that's cool. No, I play some other games too. Magic is one of the ones I kind of go back to.
Yeah.
Just as a, I pick it up and put it down. Like I play on online mostly now. But I every now and then I'll choose to like get a modern or what it is, Pioneer staple or something just to add to my collection. Because I don't play the sets regularly right now.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And then that's the other cool thing about Eternal formats. And 40K is very much an Eternal game in that. If you do buy certain evergreen units, like Intercessors now are proving to be the unit in the secondhand shop, I call them like the sweet units or the evergreen units that'll always sell. So those are the ones I'm always looking for, and across multiple editions, with the exception of drop pods, which I think were the only exception where they briefly in 8th edition were just impossible to sell. But yeah, basically, you just take up staples, format staples, like you said, and that keeps you in the game and kind of always keeps you toe in, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that's neat. Well, again, I just love it, scratching that kind of nerd itch.
Yeah. What do you play in Magic? Just curious.
Just in general, I tend to gravitate towards green and black.
Okay. Okay. And so you play Commander? I imagine everyone plays Commander.
I have
now.
A Commander deck, but I don't actually play. It's one of those to where, yeah, it was neat and I built one and I've actually got a couple of pre-cons.
Right on.
But, getting 5 or 6 people together, it just doesn't seem to work out unless we're playing 40K or some miniature-based game. But that's just the circles that I run in.
Yeah, absolutely. Magic's cool. So what else do you play other than Magic?
Oh, man, I'm a ton of board games. I really enjoy most, board games, some that you can take an hour to play. Like, Betrayal at the House on the Hill is probably my favorite board
game. Amazing. The game's great.
Yeah, it has so much replayability. I recently played a game called Village Pillage, which is like an advanced rock, paper, scissors game. I thought that was kind of cool to play in an hour. My second favorite board game, and the one that I actually break out more frequently than others, and people have heard me talk about this on the show before, is Tokaido, which is a really like subtle board game to where you don't really understand that you're absolutely slaying your friends until about you get about halfway through the game.
Tokaido. I've heard of that. I feel like it comes in like a white box, right?
It does. It's beautiful. It's so well done. You can explain the rules in a minute or two.
Is that the one where you're traveling and you're picking up life experiences?
That's
right.
You are traveling across Japan and it's how you enrich yourself along the way. Each character, and there's probably, 15 or so different characters, have different goals. And mm-hmm. you're getting more points if you play in their wheelhouse. But you get to choose like what foods to eat, what souvenirs mm-hmm. to buy, if you relax at the hot springs, if you choose to visit the church or paint pictures. I mean, these are all things your characters are doing, which are accumulating points, which again goes back to absolutely slaying your opponents.
Yeah, yeah. I actually just recently jumped into board games. I met a group of people here in Vegas that they play like really advanced strategic board games that you have to watch entire YouTube videos to learn the rules of things like Terra Mystica and Terraforming Mars. These, if anyone's played those, but I they're really, really fun. And they've recently reinvigorated my love for board games. So I bought like the full set of Villainous because my wife and I are big Disney fans.
All right.
And so super cool. But on the topic of board games, moving back to 40K a little bit, because this is something I've always wanted to talk about. I wish GW would have leaned into their board games harder, right? Because there was a period when they were coming out with a board game like once every couple months. That was like the Gore Chosen, the Warhammer Quest Silver Tower box game.
Silver Tower's great. So, I mean, it's Blackstone Fortress, both good games.
Blackstone Fortress.
I actually like Silver Tower, I think, a little bit more than the Blackstone Fortress because it kind of feels... you know, a lot more like Warhammer Questy, almost like a role playing game to me.
Yes.
You know, gets me in that fantasy mindset a little bit better.
Yeah, yeah, and actually, you've been around in the hobby long enough to definitely have an opinion on this, but they don't seem to be very successful compared to the huge thriving board game market that we both currently kind of experience. Why do you think that is? Like,
I mean, that's a very good question. I haven't thought about it too much because, you know, I see some of these games as almost like a vehicle for miniatures,
mm-hmm.
which is yeah. completely fine. And it allows you to kind of diversify where eyeballs will find your intellectual property. So I don't know if it's a loss leader or not. I don't know if that's the case. Of course, not seen any numbers, but I think it's a way for them to get more eyeballs on what, you know, what their core is, you know, and a way to funnel people back towards the core. But in the past, I think the board games have been were focused more on that full total compartmentalized board game experience. Things like Fury of Dracula and Talisman and
yeah.
things of that nature. And, you know, but with the way it is now, I don't even know that if we as a community has given these games enough of a real chance because we were just focused on the miniatures and how to funnel them back into our 40K because we're so, you know, addicted to that 40K right now.
That's a really good take that I've never considered.
I mean, I have not played the new Space Marine game, like the one that's in Target. Mm-hmm. I haven't done it. I don't know that I will. but the ones that I've focused on, I've really enjoyed.
Yeah, yeah, and it is really strange. I think you've probably hit somewhere close to the mark in that they are vessels for miniatures, and that can be a little intimidating for people who have board games. I know personally the board game group I play with, all of their board games, between all of them, they've probably painted one model, and generally there isn't any miniatures that you have to paint or any assembly with those board games. So that was always kind of my thought process. But yeah, it's super fascinating. Just looking at GW's market moves other than just selling 40K and Age of Sigmar miniatures. Because there's so much, you know, being on the retail side of things, there's so much more that they're doing as a company. That's just really always fascinating to me.
Yeah, it is neat to watch, and you know we don't see how it all plays out, but it is obviously something's working really well.
Oh yeah, definitely working really well. they're blowing the doors off of sales for everyone. So
yeah, just if I can jump us back to board games, I actually spotted a board game that I want to play that I've not gotten yet, but it sounds like it might be right up your friend's alley. It's called The King's Dilemma.
The King's Dilemma. Familiar with it.
I can't endorse it because I haven't played it yet, but I've watched a review of it and it sounds really cool. Is that you the king is almost like an NPC. Nobody plays the king, you don't care about the king. You play all these noble houses that are like trying to put forth agendas, and then as I understand it, each playthrough of the game you're playing a subsequent generation of whatever it is you started as.
Nice. You're trying to curry favor, but as these houses.
But also like pass your own types of agendas. There's two types of paths to victory. There's I forget what the good side is, but the bad side is called the crave. And so if you're passing all these selfish agendas, you're trying to get like selfish points, and you're passing all these, you know, these humanitarian things, then it's another path to victory. But it sounds really neat, and it seems like each playthrough is, you know, 45 minutes to an hour. And if you get, you know, then you can play through a couple of nights worth of almost like a mini campaign. I'm looking forward to trying it out. Might be something that you guys are interested in.
Next LVO, if you get it, I will play it.
King's Dilemma. We'll see. It looks cool. The playthrough look cool. So, if I can, I've actually sent a message out to some of my friends that I think would be into that, and, see if they want to do it. Cause I think you definitely need, 4 or 5 people to jam.
Oh yeah, well, we can get 4 or 5 people at LVO for sure.
Oh yeah, man! But I love those types of expanded board games. I was a big fan of all those, you know, Axis and Allies type games when mm-hmm. they originally came out, and then you know have played things like the Twilight Imperium. But then you got like, man, if I'm spending 4 or 5 hours on a game, I might as well be playing 40K.
That's true. Twilight Imperium I played one game once, and yeah, it's definitely a beast. For those of you who don't know, Twilight Imperium. It's a game that can take 6 hours more, 6+ hours sometimes. And yeah, like you said, 40K might be the game that you want to play. I've definitely played a couple of board games where I'm like, well, I could just be playing with one buddy and we'd be done by now. But here I am terraforming Mars and I'm losing badly.
Oh, but I like the experience. Getting folks over to play these games is sometimes there are games you can definitely tell like the commitment level of your friends who's over there. You know, whether it be, you know, they're just there are a couple who like comics or something. So you think they might like a little bit of a board game, and you break out something that's just whatever their commitment level is, and that's And that's why I like things like the advanced rock, paper, scissors I was talking about earlier. Sometimes just great to break out, like Munchkin kind of thing.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There's board games for every age group. Well, almost every age group. There's board games for every kind of casual gamer, or if you want to get something more immersive, it's super cool. Kind of like 40K, honestly. That's something that I haven't really seen a lot of people talk about in 40K, is that there are ways to get people into 40K without just playing the game, right? Because people balk at the prices, but there's so much more that you can do. Like I actually met someone who just listened to a podcast. It was like a narrative podcast, and then she was like, "Oh yeah, I don't know anything about 40K," but she quoted Gilliman at me, and I was like, "How did you know who Gilliman was?" And she's like, "Oh, you know, that's just a podcast I'm listening to, and I really like the lore of the Horus Heresy." And I was like, "Wait a minute, how on earth have you heard about the Horus Heresy? We've known each other for years, and you've literally never talked once about my actual profession.
I have not mentioned one Warham."
No, and then she's quoting like Gilliman from Unremembered Empire. I mean, I was like, "What? Where did you hear that?" She's like, "Oh, there's this podcast, and I just listen to them, and I really like all they do is talk about the Horus Heresy."
Randomly spit out, like, were you doing anything remotely space marine related? Or did she you just drive it in the car and she's like, you know, surrender to the heresy filth?
We were just at like a Thanksgiving. Like it was just like, she's a friend of the family. She's not like a cousin or anything. We have a large Mexican family, so there's lots of those. And I was just talking about like my job. And they asked me like who my favorite characters were, and I was like, "Oh, the Ultramarines. They're like super stoic. They're like the good guys, and they're blue." And she's like, "Oh, Gilliman, something like duty and honor, something something." And I was like, "Okay, how on earth did you know that?"
Confident. Like, oh. What's going on?
yeah. It was she mispronounced his name because it's actually Gilliman, but she was like Gilliman, and I was like, "Wait a minute, what?"
Hey, so. Yeah. I mean, people that only read it, you know, they don't know what, like. Who knows how to say Rabute Gilliman?
Rabute Gilliman, yeah. Yeah, it's that kind of opened up my eyes to the idea of people enjoying any part of 40K. It's a huge, huge hobby. There's so much aspects to it, right? You can listen to audiobooks. You can paint only solely miniatures. You can play the video games like Space Marine or any of the multiple app games as well. And there's just a ton of ways to get into it.
Okay, man. Well, Pablo, where can people find you if they want to hear more about what you're putting down?
Oh, well, you can find me on the Frontline Gaming Network, specifically on the Chapter Tactics 40K podcast. However, the Frontline Gaming Network has a ton of podcasts on it. It has The Art of War, Chapter Tactics, Signals from the Frontline, and of course, as you've heard them on Forza Narrative, 40K Stat Center.
Grant, thanks for coming on. I look forward to catching up with you in the future. And yeah, man, I'm going to tell you more about these board games I've been playing.
Nice. Cool. Thanks, man. Thanks, Paul, for having me on.
Have a good night.
Bye.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. We are back. I've got Ricky, the Shards of Narsil.
Oh, that's so good.
I've been reforged into the Flame of the West. Hey, can we talk about this for a second, that Glamdring is Quenya for Foe Hammer? It's a sword. It's Gandalf's sword, but its name means Foe Hammer. Does that not bother anyone?
Look, what you're failing to understand is that's translated into the men's language, right?
Westron.
Yeah, yes. Right? So it means something different in the Elven language.
Well, it means Foe Hammer.
Yeah. No, that's when you translate it into, it's like talking about like burritos.
Oh, do you know what I learned? I learned the other day, Bilbo Baggins. Do you know what his real name is?
Each one more inappropriate than the next.
Yeah, right. I sometimes look when I edit the show, right? Some of the silence gets cut out.
keep it in here.
Yes. Everyone should know that there has been a long pause in between. We were all figuring out what we can say on air.
It's not dirty. It's not dirty. Okay. Bilbo Baggins' actual name is Bilbo Labinghi.
Labinghi. He's a boy. He's a boy from the Bronx.
Yeah, it has a...
Old man Labinghi.
I can't take him seriously, but Bilbo Labinghi is Bilbo Baggins' actual name.
Makes a mean calzone.
Oh, man. We were actually, during the break, where we were chatting, we were talking about the various things in Middle-earth, and as you can tell...
It's devolved, yeah. It's devolved into... The one time Chris Morgan is on here, when I'm on here, and we're talking more about Middle Earth than Warhammer, and you know he's going to be furious.
Good.
Catch him up next week.
That's what you get.
We didn't introduce the Rohirrim, Adam Camilleri.
Nice. I ride kangaroos there.
A one-man cavalry.
I would pay to see that.
Yeah. Mate, there are some kangaroos big enough here that I could ride them. They would probably eviscerate me, but I'd give it a crack at least once.
Do they hang out near your place? Or like how close are you to...
Within a couple of k's from my house, I could find kangaroos probably. I live in like a decent sized rural city. So, and like you drive any direction, like a couple of k's, chances are you can come across kangaroos.
Are they like deer? Like,
that's,
deer
what, that's could, what I was going to ask. Are they our deer?
Roam through.
Yeah, pretty much. They just roam around, do whatever they want. You can't actually make fences tall enough to stop them. They can like jump over like 6-foot fences, apparently. So no one even bothers. Yeah. And yeah, just like deer, like you have like some of them that will literally just leave you alone. They won't even care. You can walk out right next to them as long as you're not being threatening. And other ones will just kick your absolute face off.
Guys, like I was going to make like a joke about like, you know, kangaroos versus deer and all that. I just Googled it while we were talking. I found a video of a deer fighting a kangaroo, and it's everything you want it to be.
Does the kangaroo wreck it?
Kangaroo's kicking its butt right now.
So male sheep, yeah, can be very stupid. They're very stupid animals. And sometimes they'll decide to be like to staunch up and be territorial towards kangaroos. Never going to win that fight. Kangaroo will kick the crap out of it every time. Even like the big meat sheep, like the 250-pound meat sheep.
Is that the Latin definition?
Sheep. Meat sheep, yeah. Meat sheep. Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't know how we got here, but yeah, here we are. So thanks, everyone.
Don't even care.
Are you going to leave the variety hour thing I put in at the start? Because it's literally what we've become. This is the Forge and Narrative variety hour with Adam, Paul, and Ricky.
Well, it's an interesting time, right? So we talked about the FAQ, right? So the FAQ has changed what is open to actually play. So I think that we're going to see a resurgence of lists. And so I think the topic you were talking about is like how to play when you're down a little bit is really topical right now, because more things have been kind of risen up slightly.
Very, very true. So the reason that Imperial Fists and Iron Hands were like top of the pile was because that they had an absurd level of damage output that was consistent for 6 turns. They only get one of those turns now. And so like the overall damage output of armies has just come down considerably. Like the next best one, like the next best 6 turn output army might in fact be Eldar. It might be this Mechdar list with like the expert crafters might be the next best like full damage output army. I mean, I'm sure there's a Space Marine army that's
consistent, like removing 2 or 3 targets a turn.
Yeah, consistently for 6 turns.
Yeah.
I feel like Space Marines probably still have that, but off the cuff, I think Eldar are right up there now. Like they can do almost everything Marines can do, Eldar can still do now. Maybe a little bit worse, but just as potent in the right hands.
Well, it's opened the door for like Ultramarines. Like, Ultramarines have been kind of like sleeper good forever, but clearly overshadowed by the Raven Guard, Iron Hands, and Imperial Fist. Like just clearly overshadowed. And now, you know, the Ultramarines got a little bit of a back door opened up for them.
Just by the virtue of the fact that you can stay in Tactical Doctrines twice. And then they're probably one of the, I would say, the least affected chapter by this change, right? Because of all of their abilities to manipulate the doctrines. They're going to be able to stay in whatever doctrine they want to be in for pretty much the whole game, or put a specific unit in whatever doctrine they want to be in for the whole game. They were great before. yeah, they took a little hit, so hey, they may burn another CP or so, but guess what? They're already going to have a ton of them anyway because of Gilliman. Yeah, they're still sitting pretty.
And just by nature of all that damage output, the aggression being like, so where did Raven Guard excel is that they were able to put Centurions, you know, damage 3 or more reliable attacks in your face turn 1. Basically nothing you can do about it.
Yeah.
And then the damage output from other lists are deleting 2 or 3 things a turn. Now they're deleting 1.5, 1 thing a turn, going into turn 2, 3, and 4, which makes some armies a little bit more playable. I mean, like Necrons. Necrons were on the fringe for a little bit.
I feel like Necrons actually got a decent boost out of this. It's also funny that we talked about Dark Angels taking a hit before, but Dark Angels are actually the only army that retain the ability to do what Iron Hands used to do. So they're now the only army that I think can reliably still take Stalker Bolters because of their specialist litany. So you can still take 30 to 50 Stalker Bolter Intercessors and have them all hitting on 3s on the move still. And then you add in Azrael and they've all got a 4+ invulnerable as well. So you've got this big blob of reliable 2 damage output. So they're like almost, they could almost be seen as the anti-marine marines. And that's a big call, big call, but anti-infantry marines.
I think I'm going to rely on Sacramento Guard for that. But
A 5-man intercessor squad with stalkers, though, like, you do not discount that. Like, it is good. Like, it's going to kill Primaris well.
And on top of that, like, aggressors, I mean, now obviously we're actually going to see a lot more aggressors because they're one of the better plays for Dark Angels. They're possibly one of the best plays for Ultramarines now. And now Ultramarines are going to come back in popularity. And they're also the natural successor for Raven Guard now that they're using their Master of Ambush can't be used on Centurions. Yeah, aggressors are the next obvious successor to that.
I think aggressors still need a little bit of help. I think they will continue to get better and better with each release.
Yeah, that's probably a safe call.
Yeah. So probably not bad if you want to invest into some aggressors right now. This is probably a good time where they're on the cusp of availability and power level. Like power level in the game, not power level, you know, the stat.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I've been preaching aggressor since they come out. So, and they just keep getting better. So I'm happy that I called something for once. Right. But, I love aggressors and Dark Angels aggressors, especially put 18 Bolter aggressors around Azrael, walk them across the table, win. But hey, I still, as far as Ultramarines go, I still think Centurions are fantastic. I'd be hard pressed to take if I was running Ultramarine Centurions, but for me, Ultramarine Centurions, I'm running them with Bolters and Heavy Bolters, or, you know, Hurricane Bolters and Heavy Bolters. I'm not trying to charge them in with, you know, Flamers or anything Raven Guard wise. So I still think Ultramarines, Devastator Centurions are still fantastic.
Yeah, not bad. I love how y'all tried to skip over my Necron comment. I'm going back to that.
No, right no. Yeah. we can go back to it, but if you want me talking in this,
Necrons suffer from the fact they've got some expensive one wound troops, right? That you couldn't reliably hide them for more than a couple of turns. And then you just get picked off at your AP is, you know, basically, you know, set to tatters, right?
Yeah.
But now you've only got to hide them for one turn to wait out that Devastator Doctrine, and then you get to play the game a little bit.
Because they're, what, one wound, 4+ save for a normal warrior? Is that right?
For the warrior, it's a 4+. For the immortal, it's a 3+.
3+, yeah.
But then, you know, still toughness 4. One wound doesn't get you very far.
It doesn't go far, yeah.
I love Necrons. Necrons are one of my favorite fluff armies. One of my favorite armies. Now they're sitting in this kind of weird. They're actually sitting in kind of a weird spot. They liked all the big multi damage like Imperial Fist list. They loved that. Do you know why? Because quantum shielding was just so much exponentially better. Like the more damage output you're doing, the better quantum shielding.
Oh, 6 wounds, no problem. Got it all day.
I got an inverted 2+ against this bad boy. Aren't you regretting your life choices? But bam.
Trying to turn their chapter tactics off. Yeah, I need to get out of this.
I need to change for Dev Doctrine. But at the same time, they did suffer quite a lot, and they actually suffer more from, like, so their vehicles and stuff actually get worse now with all the tactical doctrine stuff. Like spamming strength 4 -2 is actually worse for them than then in some ways the things like the Thunderfire cannons doing 2 damage at strength 5 with -2, they're still all bad. But at least you have a say when they're multi-damage. At least you have an option when it's multi-damage. And on the reverse, your things like Doomsday Arcs are very, with the right buffs and the right use, are quite reliable at picking up things like Repulsory Executioners, things of this ilk, because you've got the massive multi-damage stuff. And I pray that when they get Psychic Awakening, they can have those things become like a little bit more reliable in some way. Maybe it's 2d6, take the highest for the amount of shots.
Yeah, or that's the worst. When you're harsh, I mean, look, if you're a Necron player and you're playing against me, you're going to roll all your Will Be Backs. You're going to roll a bunch of sixes a day. Life is going to be great for you if you're playing me, but you're not always going to be playing me. You got to rely on that d6.
Well, see, that's the other thing as well. So each individual Necron model is paying a points premium for like the reanimation, yeah? And yet the game is so like killy at the moment. The damage output of units is so killy that rule really rarely comes into effect. I would really love to see. Do you know what? Actually, you know, this would be sick. This would be great. I've actually spruced this a little bit. Psychic Awakening, 2 CP stratagem. When a Necron unit is wiped at the end of that phase, pay 2 CP. One model from that unit comes back to life.
Are you wishlisting right now?
I'm wishlisting. Okay. They wipe a unit of 10 Necron Warriors, 2 CP, one of them comes back to life at the end of that combat phase or whatever, and then the start of your next turn, you get the option to resurrection back. And maybe you've got a Ghost Arc for a double res or a res orb.
No information on Necrons. We don't know what could possibly happen. But they will, you know, every faction is going to get touched in some way, that's for sure.
But that is a pure spitball. That is a massive spitball. That would be a dream come true for me, I reckon. I'd love that. Because then all of a sudden, like, things like, you imagine that on a unit of Lich Guard, a max unit of Lich Guard. Your opponent's like chewing this super tough steak. In my scene, we used to call it the Cinder Block when you'd make that Necron Lich Guard Death Star with all the characters in it.
Bouncing stuff.
Yeah, you couldn't contend with the Cinder Block. I'd love to see like that super tough Necron steak. You know, it's a $2 steak from the dive around the corner, and it's like, wow, I don't want to have to eat this, but I got to do it if I want to win the game, kind of thing. And I love that. I want Necrons to have that back, because at the moment they just feels like, it just feels like the list is almost auto build. It's almost on auto build. I mean, it's not auto play. There's a lot of nuance. There's a lot of depth to that list and that faction, but the list is just like, oh yeah, it starts with my 3 Doomsday Arcs. Starts with my Min Battalion, yeah. With my my Staff of Light, and then I can sprinkle in Wraiths if I want, or I sprinkle in Destroyers, or I sprinkle in these 2 or 3 other choices. And yeah, I'm never a fan of that, of a whole faction being polarized down to like auto taking.
Well, I think mission sets have a lot to do with what you take as your auto include. What are your performing units in every list? But still, you can't deny though that the ratcheting down of some of these more dominant, like obvious Class A power level lists. Bringing them down helps lift up some of these other things.
No, that's great. I'm about getting the game balanced and let's get everybody in there. Let's just make sure the Dark Angels end up a little higher up than the others. That's all I'm saying.
You just don't want to be an FAQ casualties. Like, stop.
And I just want to be able to. I want to be able to play the Dark Angels. I like. And that's the thing is like. A few things in the Dark Angels got a good boost, and then they got a nerf, and then I feel like half of the Dark Angels Codex is still meh, but the other Marine armies are still like taking advantage of these things, and it's going to hit us harder.
Blood Angels came out smelling like a rose. I got so many messages that day. It's like, so do we care about this? Like, nope.
No, you're good. Yeah, nope, drive on. Fine. Yeah, nothing changed.
Well, you got like a backhanded buff.
Yeah.
It's like, we nerfed all this stuff that actually was a headache for you. So you just actually got better, which is fantastic.
100%. Yeah. But honestly, like my Primaris list, my 100% Dark Angels Primaris list, because I enjoy pain, I guess. The only thing that changed was my Stalker Bolt Rifles went back to the Rapid Fire Bolt Rifles. That was it. So from that aspect, it didn't really affect me a whole lot. But when you start adding in Raven Wing and stuff like that, then it was a much tougher pill to swallow.
Heck yeah. Well, gentlemen, thanks a lot for joining me tonight.
No worries. Thanks for having me. Where's my third Lord of the Rings reference? God.
Oh, you need one. Come on.
I had one before and it's gone.
You're the worst at this.
They am. They have a cave, Ricky. They have a cave tribe. I don't know.
That was garbage. That was garbage.
That was trash. That was so bad.
That still only counts as
perfect. There you go. That's fantastic.
Good night, everybody.
Chris is going to be so mad.
A chance for Adam, man of Australia, to show his quality.
We'll see y'all.
Good night.
Baby in the corner.